Coming up on Weekend America.
In a dragging economy, money can be tight.
Our bank account went from a couple of thousand down to, I think we have $21 right now in our savings account. And, it, you know, I laugh about it because if you don't, you're going to cry.
Weekend Americans tell us how they're surviving tough times. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. Maybe this weekend you're buying Valentine's Day chocolate, but who makes it?
If I feel like I'm getting something, I'll stop doing it because I'm no longer has any attraction. Chocolate's great because it's just one frustration after another.
We'll go to one of the world's smallest chocolate factories, and later one man remembers an unforgettable concert.
They were having this rock festival north of Toronto in Ontario, Strawberry Fields. And I took off without a ticket and started hitchhiking, and people would yell, "Get a job, get a haircut,
get a front row seat." It's all on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. A slowing economy means a different kind of weekend for many of you. This hour, we'll hear your stories of shrinking savings, rising prices, and discovering happiness that doesn't cost a thing. What are you doing this weekend?
Well, probably babysitting for my grandchildren. One of them is only a year and a half old, and the other one is three, and it's a little bit busy.
My plans for this weekend are to go to the Barney's sale and buy a suit for my boyfriend.
Probably hanging out, taking my daughter to her practices.
I'm going to go dancing.
Our staff party is on Sunday, which is also my birthday, and we're going to do karaoke, and it's going to be a lot of fun.
Getting ready for Valentine's Day. Working in a flower shop.
Well, I guess you can't impress her loved ones with roses.
No, that doesn't count for much. Those voices came from Brooklyn, Cincinnati, and Bothell, Washington.
Well, there's been a lot of news lately about the stalling economy. As the New York Times put it this week, with the number of jobs shrinking, housing prices falling, and debt levels swelling, the same nation that pioneered that no-money-down mortgage suddenly confronts an unfamiliar imperative. More Americans must live within their means.
Well, now that there's a tentative deal on the writer's strike, maybe Americans can get back to one of their favorite free weekend pastimes, watching scripted television. Here on Weekend America, we wanted to know how the economy is affecting your weekend. How do you enjoy your weekends when you're worried about money, or what do you do on the weekend when you're low on cash?
My name's Eileen Neifenbisch. This is how my weekends are in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. My husband and I live in an 1890s old house with our mentally retarded adult daughter. My husband is a couple years younger than I, and Jim worked for a large company here in Lancaster that a couple years ago started closing its doors and laying people off, and he was one of the ones that lost his job in that transition. Since we live at home with our daughter and I'm somewhat handicapped, it's not been easy to go out at our ages and find employment. My husband has looked for a job, but when you're in your late 50s and you go out and you try to find employment, even if you've been a terrific worker for 30-some years, nobody really is that interested in you. So as far as being able to go out and do things, it just isn't happening. One of the things that we don't have anymore is mad money or money to do things on a weekend. We don't have the cushions. Our bank account went from a couple of thousand down to, I think we have $21 right now in our savings account. I laugh about it because if you don't, you're going to cry, you know, so you don't really have much of a choice. And of course, we sit in a house that we've lived in for 30-some years that has a lot of charm, and we love it, but at the same time, it has a old-fashioned heater because it was built in the 1890s, and the rise in heating oil prices has wiped out anything that we did have. The last time we filled up, we paid $3.58 a gallon for home heating oil, and when you put that into a 200-gallon tank and, you know, at a cold winter, you're doing that a lot.
To
to do some things that are fun. We enjoy watching different programs, and we play games. We play a lot of Scrabble. We read a lot. Just be with friends and family. I enjoy really cooking for them. That's one of the things that disappoints me when I think about the downturn in the economy. Food prices have gone, for us, very, very high. And things like, you know, the nice old-fashioned Sunday dinner with family that you used to enjoy doing aren't really easy to do anymore. At least for us, they're not.
My name is Tom Griffiths. I actually live in Los Angeles, California, but I'm the pastor of First United Methodist Church in Temple City, California, which is about 12 miles or so east of Los Angeles. One surprising thing about my job is the financial counseling that I've done. I was able to help one other minister who became disabled, and we worked out a rearrangement of her mortgage with her bank that would allow her to lower the payment. So it was interesting renegotiating a loan with a bank. When I'm preaching a sermon, sometimes I do talk about how the economy affects us and how do we try to live out our faith as well through our financial choices. And that sometimes we may need to think about what would be the best for the long term.
My name is Anna Hirsch, and Portland is one of the most fantastic places, I do have to say that, to live in when you don't have a whole lot of money in terms of having things to do. First of all, the food up here is amazing, and it's affordable. All the places that you go are really friendly, so we bring our cribbage board or a deck of cards, our little old granny games, and we go out and we play games at the bars, and you can just kind of make a night of it. There's a number of movie theaters here that have liquor licenses, so you can get beer, you can have pizza, and you can take it into the theater, and tickets to the movies are only about $3, and, you know, $1.50 on an amazing piece of pizza, you know, $2 on a beer, and you can go in and eat and drink while you watch the movie. And then Oregon is known for its outdoor activity as well, so there's just a lot to do here.
I'm Cindy Krieger from Lansing, Michigan. I don't spend as much time on my weekends visiting with family. I spend more time by myself doing things close to home instead of traveling out and visiting people. I probably drive 8,000 to 10,000 miles a year less now than I did a few years ago. I just don't feel that I can spend that kind of money that we have to spend for gas these days, and it shows when I tally up how much I've driven every year. Pretty much every weekend I would go visit somebody, and now I think twice before I hop in the car and drive off to see somebody. Well, I know I talk to my parents a lot more now than I used to. I talked to them last night for almost an hour, and I never used to call my parents and talk like that.
That was Cindy Krieger in Lansing, Michigan, Anna Hirsch in Portland, Oregon, Pastor Tom Griffith in Los Angeles, and Eileen Niefenbisch in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Will you contribute? We want to know, how is our sluggish economy changing your weekend, if it is? You can read the original letters for this story and contribute your own at our website, weekendamerica.org.
We've heard a lot about how voters divide along race and class lines when they get into the voting booth. But it also matters where voters live. And we're not talking about the North-South divide. Voters in rural areas are voting differently than their urban counterparts. That holds true across the country. It could significantly affect how the election plays out over the coming months. Bill Bishop is the editor of an online magazine devoted to rural issues. It's called The Daily Yonder. Bill, you've done a breakdown of how rural America voted on Super Tuesday. And with Mike Huckabee vowing to stay in the race, it's down to essentially two candidates for both parties. So how did rural voters come down on the candidates?
Of course, on the Republican side, Mike Huckabee did really well in the rural South. And in rural general, he essentially tied nationally with John McCain. And on the Democratic side, we found that Senator Obama did much better in urban areas than Senator Clinton, and Senator Clinton seemed to pull better from ex-urban and rural areas.
Now, were you surprised by these results?
It just plays against type, which is that Barack Obama is the post-partisan candidate. But what we found was that he pulls best from really the bluest of blue communities. And Senator Clinton, who was supposed to be the divisive candidate from, you know, way back in the 90s, did better in the redder kind of purplish counties in rural America.
So what do you think accounts for that?
We always talk about issues. Well, it's like issues, smishes. The way people join a party, it's like going to you have a choice of cocktail parties, and you look in the door and you scan the people and you see if they look like you. And if they look like you, then you go in and join the party. You can really see that, I think, with the chord that Senator Obama strikes in young urban people. And Senator Clinton, she goes to a different cocktail party within the Democratic Party, and those people look different, act different. It's just a different group. It's a split within the party that's also a split geographically in the United States.
And like you said, that's counterintuitive, even to the vibe of their campaigns.
Right. It depends on what you think is going to happen in the fall, I think, as to whether this is important or not. Is this next election all about bringing out the base, much like the 2004 election, especially on the Republican side? If so, then it seems like Senator Obama can really bring out that core Democratic base. Or is the election about who can reach sort of into those middle areas of, you know, the few people who are left who are independents? And if you look at it that way, and I know that's the way the Clinton people look at it, they say this shows that that she's better able to reach in and get those people who don't live in strongly Democratic areas.
And how is this playing out on the Republican side?
I think the Republicans would say, look, we've been losing those inner suburb areas of cities because we've scared off a lot of the people that live there with really strongly socially conservative speech and platforms. And what McCain allows us to do is to get back into those cities where there are a heck of a lot of votes.
Well, Bill, I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bill's book on political divisions comes out in May. It's called The Big Sort: How the Clustering of Like-Minded America is Tearing Us Apart.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
Coming up, Mitt has quit, an angry billionaire loves puppies, and Americans don't love nature as much as they used to. Good, bad, or no news next on Weekend America. Thank you. This is Weekend America from American Public Media. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Our radio show is about what's happening this weekend, and it includes hindsight. The media have told you what happened this week, but how you feel about it is not always obvious. So we are looking back now and divvying up the week into its good news, bad news, and no news. Joining us are Yale literature professor Amy Hungerford. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Bill.
Gustavo Arellano writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Guillermo.
¿Qué onda, Gustavo?
Mucho.
I'm sure. And Luke Burbank hosts the Seattle radio show Too Beautiful to Live. Hey, Luke.
Hi, William.
Our first topic. Super Tuesday has left the Democrats battling while conservative Republican kittens have lost their mittens. Is this good, bad, or no news?
I think this is very good news. Yeah. As a Democrat, I'm very pleased to have two candidates who I think the party is excited about. I'm excited about both of them. I have my preferences, but however it turns out, I think the tight race will make them both more competitive after this is all over and we have one nominee.
Hmm. Defying the pundits. Others?
I think McCain getting the nod is super good news for George W. Bush.
Hmm?
And let me explain why. Because you remember back in 2000, Bill, how McCain got totally done by George W. Bush in South Carolina?
South Carolina, yeah.
And how he just kind of took it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if McCain would have not gotten the nomination this time around, I think there's like about an 85% chance that George W. Bush would have died by McCain's hand. So the fact that that's not happening, I'm going to say that's a good thing.
Good news for President Bush.
I think it's great news just because I really think Mitt Romney's the Antichrist, and not because of his religion. He's going to say that, oh, because I'm Mormon, somehow people are going to say I'm not, godly or whatever. But no, the man was a flip-flopper. The man just was ready to spend his fortune to win this nomination. And thankfully, good sense prevailed in the sense that good Americans made sure to not vote for him. Even Huckabee supporters will not vote for him. Although in their case, I really think they do think he's Antichrist because he is Mormon.
Plus, Mitt Romney is, I think, a robot, which I don't know constitutionally.
You have to have been assembled in the United States.
Right, exactly. I'm no Jeff Toobin, but I think that is constitutionally shaky to actually elect a robot.
Right. Okay, for our next topic, let's go to the audio tape. The man you're about to hear is the new owner of the Tribune newspaper chain, billionaire Sam Zell. He's getting to know his employees, holding a Q&A session, when one of his photographers asks how we uphold our journalistic standards when the public just wants to see photos of puppies.
You're giving me the classic, what I would call, journalistic arrogance of deciding that puppies don't count. I don't know anything about puppies. What I'm interested in is, how can we generate additional interest in our product and additional revenue so we can make our product better and better? And hopefully we get to the point where our revenue is so significant that we can do puppies and a rat. Okay?
That little parting shot was indeed the F word directed at that photographer. Does this exchange concerning the modern state of journalism strike you as good news, bad news, or no news?
I think it's a classic bad news, good news. I mean, I think the bad news, if you have seen the video, apparently Robert Duvall's character from The Apostle is now running one of America's major media organizations.
Uh-huh.
The good news, though, I think, is that he's right. I mean, it really hurts. It really hurts. But, I mean, if big newspapers are going to try to stay relevant, competing with blogs and all these other things, I do think that they have to trim the sails a little bit. And even though he's an evil, crazy codger, I think he might be a financially correct evil, crazy codger.
Others?
I'll go in. It's terrible news. And in fact, this show just illustrated it. This is why newspapers are going to die. When the Los Angeles Times wrote about this exchange, all they said about it was that Zell uttered an expletive. But they didn't say what the expletive was. Here, at least you were able to say the F word, and that's as long as we're going to say. Now, somebody like myself who wants to know what this expletive is, we're not going to go to the LA Times anymore or any other newspaper. We're going to go online. We're going to go to YouTube. We're going to see Zell in all his, F-filled glory. If the Times wants to stay relevant, not only do they have to publish stories about puppies in Iraq, they have to publish bad words as well, especially when the bad word is the story that's involved involved here.
The public wants puppies and expletives.
Yeah, terrible news. Terrible news.
I would call this bad and no. I mean, what I find really horrifying about it is the idea of what profitability has to mean. While I think, look, you're right that newspapers need to have some kind of a return on the investment, what rule says that that return has to be some huge margin? Why can't it just be enough? And then there are things that are worth doing because they're worth doing and not because they make a really big profit margin.
So you basically have a problem with a puppy running a newspaper. That's what I'm getting from you.
Well, Sam Zell obviously doesn't know anything about puppies. That's what he confessed.
I think he's a cat person.
Sam Zell is a cat person. That's the takeaway.
That would explain a lot.
Okay, our next topic. The National Academy of Sciences has published a report by conservationists that says Americans are spending less time in nature. Hiking and backpacking is slightly up, but camping, hunting, fishing, visits to national parks have been sharply declining for the last 20 years. Is that good news, bad news, or no news?
This is great news for me. I like to be alone in nature.
I think this is no news, and only because I am one of those people who have never gone to national parks. I like nature too, but my idea of nature is going to the park where there's a lot of grass, making carne asada, and leaving my plates there so other people could pick them up. That's my idea of nature.
I used to live by you.
Exactly. I think I've been near that party.
Yeah, so no news for me.
Luke?
I say bad news because, I mean, nature's great and everything. But what this study is a codified, scientific, peer-reviewed version of every day living with my mom during the summertime when I was 15.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful day.
Get outside.
Why don't you go outside or something? Apparently my mom was raised on the Upper East Side of New York or
yeah.
something. I don't even know what accent I'm doing to represent my mom.
But Luke, what about the science that we are, the humans are hardwired to love nature, and so if we're not in it, you know, we turn on each other.
I just think that we have better stuff now. At one point, we were hardwired for eating raw woolly mammoth, but thankfully, that has also expired from my DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Just like going outside. If you need me, I'll be in my pod.
Your iPod.
I think that it's not a bad thing that Luke's DNA doesn't crave woolly mammoth anymore because, of course, they're extinct. He's staying inside, so fewer other kinds of animals will become extinct. So as long as we keep hands off nature, It tends to function better.
That's true. The trout did call this good news.
Yeah.
We got a text from a trout saying this is excellent news. That's the news this week, panel. Thanks a lot.
Thanks,
Bill.
Thank you.
Amy Hungerford professes literature at Yale University. Gustavo Arellano writes the syndicated column Ask a Mexican. Luke Burbank hosts the radio show Too Beautiful to Live on Seattle's Cairo Radio. So what about you? What's your take on the news, good, bad, or no? You can vote, you can comment when you come and commune with us at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
Chocolate that brings up summer strawberries, dark roasted almonds, and pure amber honey. From the little chocolatier who could, later on Weekend America. Thank you.
This is Weekend America, the radio show that wants to know what you're doing this weekend. In this case, Des, musically speaking.
Well, this weekend, it's me and Cyndi Lauper all the way. I've got some writing to do, and those standards on her At Last CD, they'll be a perfect tone for me. I really like that version of Walk On By that she does.
My baby daughter only has the vocabulary to request the song Mbop, so that's
oh,
in heavy
Hanson.
Rotation for me. Yeah, yeah. Welcome to my world. We've asked you about the soundtrack to your weekend. Maureen McNulty Saxton listens to us in Holt, Michigan, and her weekend soundtrack is the music of Oklahoma.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day.
Maureen?
Yeah?
Why is this song the soundtrack to your weekend?
Well, my mom basically expected our house to be cleaned on Saturday. And I think being a mother of eight children, you know, one day of the week, this house was going to get in order. And that was our Saturdays. I mean, we were not allowed to do anything until the house was cleaned.
How did the music go along with the cleaning?
A couple of us kind of got involved, especially my sister Colleen. She got involved in a lot of plays, so a lot of our Saturday chores also were driven around what play Colleen was in that year.
What a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day.
In Oklahoma, that particularly spoke to Saturday to me, because when I watched the movie, it starts with Curly riding through the cornfield and singing, "Oh, what a beautiful morning." And I guess even like from the earliest days that I saw that movie and then saw the play, to me it was like, oh, that's Saturday morning because there's a dance that night.
Oh, yeah.
Visit, don't miss a tree, and old weeping willow is laughing at me. Oh, what a beautiful morning.
So when you hear this music today, do you smell the Lemon Pledge and the Ajax?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. yeah, I smell that, but I also kind of think of the great feeling of Saturday night. Saturday night was the one time where the house was kind of serene and calm, and my mom usually, while we were cleaning, a tradition for her was she made lasagna for us, and she always made bread. We only grew up on fresh bread, so it was, and on Saturday it would be garlic. I mean, she would make it garlic. So we had this great smell of lasagna, garlic bread, and Mr. Clean. It would be really nice. I miss it.
I've never heard those three lumped together before.
Yeah, it's the original aromatherapy.
When I take you out tonight with me, honey, here's the way it's going to be. You will sit behind a team of snow-white horses in the slickest gig you ever see.
How do you listen to this music now?
I love it so much. I actually have it in the car. My daughter knows. She's been listening to Oklahoma for years now. We go to everything from high school to big name productions, but to me it just reeks of family. You know, it's all about family, and so I want, you know, my kids to enjoy it as much as I do.
The wheels are yellow, the upholstery's brown.
Maureen, thank you so much for sharing your weekend soundtrack with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
You can roll right down in case there's a change in the weather.
Maureen McNulty Saxton from Holt, Michigan. Her weekend soundtrack is the musical Oklahoma. Des, we're going to have to agree to disagree on this one. Me versus you and all my other colleagues. Go to our whole collection of weekend soundtracks and listen. It's a wonderful collection of music. And while you're doing that, share your own. Tell us the story behind it, too. Won't you come visit us at weekendamerica.org.
Back home in the Surrey, riding slowly. Home.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke. Valentine's Day means chocolate, but you haven't lived until you've tasted single-origin artisan chocolate, like the kind Colin Gasco makes. At 22, he runs one of the smallest chocolate factories in the country. He calls himself the rogue chocolatier, and for good reason. It's not easy to break into the business. You have to shop globally for the beans, and the processing equipment is really expensive. So Colin's gone a different route. He's rigged a 350-square-foot warehouse space in Minneapolis with everyday machines to process his beans. We paid him a visit this week, and we knew from the chocolatey smell in the hall that we were definitely in the right place.
I'm going to need you guys to put on some hairnets. You know, I have to keep up with the FDA jurisdiction. Just want to make sure we keep the chocolate nice and clean and
all right, we'll do
delicious.
Anything for the chocolate. That's fine. Let's do it.
All right. Here we go. So these are some Trinidad beans.
Wow.
Bring them out in the light for you.
They're like the size of kidney beans.
Yeah, they sort of look like almonds. Then we go over to the roaster. Roaster is basically some small convection ovens that I've tweaked with to make them roast cocoa beans properly. Next step is to the winnower and cracker, and that breaks the beans, removes the hulls. And what we basically have then is what you would call nibs. And then the nibs go to the melanger, and now this grinds the nibs down into what you call cocoa liquor, which is liquid ground cocoa mass. I hand mix everything with sugar. Then all of that goes into this triple roll mill, and then I take what's called flake off of there, and the flake goes over here to the conch.
Now, ooh, it looks like a fondue pot.
Yeah, this is not a real conch. This is a machine that was designed for grinding batter for dosas, you know, Indian pancakes. It's been modified pretty excessively.
Who taught you all this stuff? Who taught you all of... Because it sounds like there's a lot of fine-tuning in here.
Well, I mean, you read technical manuals, you talk to other people in the industry, a lot of experimentation. I've cried a lot in this factory.
You've cried a lot?
Yeah. When you've been working 14 hours and nothing happens, you cry too. You know, it's just a constant process of tweaking. And for me, like, if I feel like I'm getting something, I'll stop doing it because it no longer has any attraction. So the chocolate's great because it's just one frustration after another.
And am I going to get to taste any chocolate today?
You bet.
All right.
You get to taste lots.
All right, I just have to know, like, is this going to be worth the wait?
And this machine is a vibrating table. And basically what it does is kind of like if you were to cast concrete, you need to shake the molds. And so if you shake it at a certain rate, you actually are able to get the bubbles out very quickly. Then they sit on a rack and they cool.
It's kind of like putting the pie in the window.
Yep.
All right.
And then I demold them. You'll notice there's no bubbling on the back. It's got a good sheen on both sides. And then if you snap it, you'll hear a nice clean break. And it'll break along a nice, a good line.
Yeah, now what kind is this?
This one is the Samburano.
Oh, wait a minute. I'm getting a complex taste here.
They have this really bright, fruity, I get a lot of like red fruit, like plums, some raisin. There's definitely a lot of citrus.
So you didn't actually add any citrus to this?
There's no citrus.
Because it tastes like I'm eating fruit and chocolate at the same time.
Yeah.
It's going straight to my brain. And my hips. Why is your company called Rogue Chocolatier?
Generally, this industry is dominated by enormous companies. You know, if you were to look at it from a business perspective, it's like, why in the world would you spend all this money and time, you know, spend 30 hours making 30 pounds of chocolate? There's no good reason to do it.
You rogue you.
Yeah, it's a crazy, stupid idea. And I wouldn't recommend it, but I love it.
That was Colin Gasco of Rogue Chocolatier in Minneapolis. We met him, and you can meet him, at our website. Just go to weekendamerica.org.
Des, you know, a lot of us think that chocolatier must be the happiest job on earth. So I wonder, what did it actually seem like to you?
Yeah, you know what? He spends 12 hours a day in that room. It's got blinding white walls and the whir of the machines that he's rigged up from things like shop vacs. And he did say that he often feels alone, like he's going to go crazy. I think the words he uses, he gets wild-eyed. And yet I'd have to say that for him, this is both art and science. Making good chocolate, achieving the right balance, that's what gives him joy. And eating it makes me happy.
Joy and pain. I heard his tears in there. Valentine's Day need not include chocolate, but it probably should include sweet nothings. We asked you how you privately tell your loved ones that you love them. And, boy, we were not prepared for some of the terms of endearment you described. Like Greg Gibbs in Sparks, Nevada, he calls his wife, well, I'll let him tell you.
To show my wife my love for her, I call her B-Barf.
B-Barf. Mm-hmm. Greg and his wife are big on word puzzles, and B-Barf is a seven-letter word for honey. So it's very clever.
My boyfriend calls me Clown Face with great affection, or CF for short.
That's listener Gretchen Kinder from Somerville, Massachusetts. And don't worry, there's a great story behind that one, too.
You know that feeling when your lips get really, really chapped and they turn bright red? Well, my family calls that condition clown mouth.
Yeah, who hasn't had clown mouth?
I was telling my boyfriend about clown mouth, and later on that same day, he asked me how my clown face was doing, completely misunderstanding or misremembering clown mouth. I thought it was so cute, because he was trying really hard to remember a family story, to show me that he was listening to what I was saying, and was trying to use a family insider story to convey that he wanted to be part of my family as well. We both laughed very hard about it, which is why I think having him continue to call me Clown Face feels like such an affectionate term of endearment.
Hi, this is Mary Brock from Exeter, New Hampshire. When I was 4 or 5 years old, I would call my dad a yucky mud soup. My dad would say, "Hi, honey." And I would say, you yucky mud soup, you. And then my dad would kind of be quiet for a minute and then say, "Okay, honey."
My girlfriend calls me Sir Puddle Snort III. In love notes and in cards, she writes SPS Roman numeral 3. She actually started calling me Snort to begin with. Well, because when I laugh, I snort. Then she started calling me Puddle Snort. I had an eye infection and my eyes started watering, and so now Puddle Snort. Finally, my girlfriend decided that, you know, I should curry favor with her and become knighted in a weird sort of way. I don't know. Anyway, now I'm Sir Puddle Snort. And we figured, of course, that there must be Sir Puddle Snort the First out there and Sir Puddle Snort the Second. It's such a common name. So I am actually Sir Puddle Snort the Third. Doing it on the moon, yeah.
In the jungle too. Well, our pet names for each other are a little bit indistinct, but they are centered around something like baloney or baloney parts, and we have interesting ways of greeting each other. And it all started rather innocently with Honey, and then became Honey Bunny. And then one day he said, just to make it more personal and maybe more intimate, to add more depth to it, he kind of evolved into Honey Baloney, and it sort of just stuck at that point and just continued to evolve over many, many years of marriage into something a lot richer and a lot more complex until it's become almost an entire language. If I were to call him on the phone, I might not call him by a name, but I would greet him with something like, "Uh-oh, ne," which is sort of this way of saying, "Hi, honey," in baloney speak. Probably he'd say, "Honey," back. Very silly. It kind of makes me laugh when I hear it coming out of my mouth.
Hi, this is Ashley Beecher, and I'm from Miami, Florida. When we want to tell each other that we love each other, instead of just saying, "I love you," we say, "so much." So it's like we're saying, "I love you so much," but we leave the "I love you" part out. And the way that came about was, it was actually the first time we had professed our love to each other. You know, we said it during the day, we told each other that we loved each other, and we sort of were honest with each other about that. And then later that night, we went out to dinner with some friends, And we were sitting there at the dinner table, you know, with all these people around us and just looking at each other. And I know that inside I just felt like at that moment I really wanted to tell him that I loved him. And I just looked at him and I knew he felt the same way. And he grabbed my hand. But as a way of not being awkward towards everybody else, I just said so much. And he just knew exactly what I meant. And so ever since then, we just say so much to each other.
You just heard from listeners Gretchen Kinder from Somerville, Mass., Mary Brock from Exeter, New Hampshire, Stephen Gentile from Davidson, North Carolina, Chris Belfi from Plymouth, Minnesota, and Ashley Beecher from Miami, Florida.
Isn't it interesting how terms of endearment are often either gross or degrading?
Yes, which makes me feel a little better since we often call our kid Puffy Stinkwater. I feel I'm so not alone now. Let's have some more fun with pet names. Pick one of the terms of endearment on our website, if you will, and draw it or make a collage or a photograph to depict these winsome words. We will post your art on our website for Valentine's Day. Go to weekendamerica.org.
Well, in Valentine, Arizona, it's going to be in the low 60s this weekend. In Hart Butte, Montana, it'll swing from zero to a balmy 34. Good weather for either a stroll or a snuggle, whichever you pick. For more weather, here's Weekend America's John Moe.
45 in Wilmington, Delaware, with rain, snow, and love in the air. The zoo offers a wild lovin' event, teaching the occasionally off-putting courting rituals of zoo residents. The male giraffe uses a raucous cough, so be careful during this flu season. The rhino snarls and hisses, while the emu prefers dinner at a bistro and a foreign film. Those romantic emus. Warmer in Montgomery, Alabama, 67 with clouds, but the animals are busy there as well. Just maybe not as busy as at that last event. At Animal Enrichment Day, learn how an elephant gets a bath and how many hats a chimp can wear. Animals in Montgomery are like, hey, do you think you could give us a ride to Wilmington, Delaware? We heard there's this crazy party going on. Eden, Utah has sun, clouds, 36 degrees, and a stiff mountaintop wind. Great weather for flying a kite with a human attached to it. The Superfly Open is for folks on skis, snowboards, or surfboards attached to kites, flying across mountainsides and, I guess, hoping for the best. It's fairly safe to strap yourself to a kite, unless you're Charlie Brown, in which case you get eaten by a tree. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Girl of Your Dreams, a Youngbloods tune, a Ferris wheel ride, oh, and 50,000 Hippies coming up on Weekend America.
Sustainability coverage supported by Calvert, mutual funds, college savings, and retirement investments in companies committed to responsible environmental, social, and governance practices. Online at calvert.com.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper.
The one song that I remember from my childhood.
The first song that I remember.
My dad used to sing it.
The most important song.
I just love to play over and over and over.
For this, our final installment of Song in Memory, we go back to 1970 with listener Harley Hansen. Harley was a college freshman. Campuses were erupting in protest. But what Harley remembers was a certain rock festival, a certain ride, and one of the most luminous songs at the time, Get Together by the Youngbloods.
My name's Harley Hansen. I live in Sacramento, California. And in 1970, I was kind of at that stage that's euphemistically called finding yourself. I knew what I didn't want to do was join the Army and go into the Vietnam War. I did not know what I wanted to do. Consequently, I was going to school.
I am sick of the racist war in Vietnam when we don't have justice in the United
and
States.
And when my first year of school ended, I did not want to go home to my parents because they were not fond of long hair. So I went out to Peterborough, New Hampshire, where my sister Karen and my brother-in-law Andrew lived, and I stayed with them. They were very nice to put me up over the summer. When I was up there and I heard that they were having this rock festival north of Toronto in Ontario, Strawberry Fields, and I took off without a ticket and started hitchhiking, and people would yell, "Get a job, get a haircut." They were not fond of seeing people hitchhiking with backpacks and long hair. I was at a rest stop, and I saw a group of three cars, New Hampshire license plate. Oh, they looked familiar. And I walked up and said, "Hey, are you from Peterborough?"
"Hey, man, how you doing?"
You know, we determined we were both going to the same place. So there I was. I had a ride directly to the rock festival with these guys. One of the people in the car was a kind of pretty girl. Have you seen the sunlight pouring through her hair? She had long, dark hair and dressed in the typical uniform of the day with the blue jeans, the beads, and the little John Lennon shades. You know, and of course, I'm 19 and, you know, basically attracted to anything that moves. We got as far as Buffalo, proceeded across the Peace Bridge there, and the Canadian authorities were not overly impressed with, you know, three carloads of hippies, and they kind of grilled us. "How much money do you have? Where are you going?" We told them we were going to the rock festival up in Ontario. "Well, the rock festival doesn't start till tomorrow." Okay, so back across the bridge, and when we got back to the south end of the bridge, "Oh, welcome to the United States. Unroll your sleeping bag. Put all your contents of your pockets on this table." They searched us thoroughly, asked me for ID, said, "Where's your draft card?"
"Do you know of any reason why you might not qualify for military service?"
"No, I don't have any reasons."
"Okay." I didn't have my draft card on me since it had been destroyed in a very unfortunate small fire earlier, and I'm sure they suspected I was evading the draft. Finally, they let me go, and there were 300 or 400 hippies out there waiting to get across the bridge. They all been turned back just as we had. The next day, the rock festival started. Grand Funk Railroad was there, and Canned Heat, and Sha-na-na, and the Youngbloods. And anyway, I was wandering around the festival site with this pretty girl, and we noticed that there was a carnival up on this little hill kind of at the back of the concert site, and we decided for some reason we wanted to ride the Ferris wheel. So we get on the Ferris wheel, and it just happened to stop right on top, and we're pretty much in the catbird seat overlooking this whole grounds of 50,000 people, and the Youngbloods at that second happened to launch into "Let's Get Together." Come on, people now. And so I kind of look over at this beautiful woman thinking, maybe I should try to kiss her. And then I thought, no, I'll make a fool of myself. And then, of course, the Ferris wheel started up. The song ended, and we wandered back to our group and enjoyed the rest of the three-day rock and roll event. I saw her a time or two after that around town, but then that was it. And I always wondered over the years, you know, what happened to this person? Love is but a song we sing. Fears we will die. Of course, now to this day, when I hear the Youngbloods play "Let's Get Together," I close my eyes. You can make the mountains ring, or make the angels cry. And I can feel the sun on my face, and I'm back, a 19-year-old in 1970, on top of a Ferris wheel, stopped, overlooking the grounds of 50,000 hippies, and the Youngbloods are on stage playing that song. Come on, people now, smile on your brother, everybody get together, try to love one another. So anybody from Peterborough, New Hampshire, who went to the Strawberry Fields Festival in late July or early August of 1970, if you were in a group of three cars, one of which was a Mustang, and you rode the Ferris wheel while the Youngbloods were playing, you need to get in touch with them.
Harley Hansen lives in Sacramento, California. Our Song in Memory series is produced by Ann Hepperman, Kara Oler, and Rick Moody, with production help from Lila Dobbs. And you know, you can see a video of that Strawberry Fields concert that Harley went to in 1970, as well as all the other stories from our Song in Memory series at our website. Come see us at weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, produced with Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Neely Allel, who's working on a short story this weekend about Orange County in the 70s, Millie Jefferson, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfiel, Susie Lechtenberg's headed for the Rose Bowl Flea Market in Pasadena Sunday to scour for treasures, also Tim Bomba.
And Johnny Vince Evans, who's not doing a thing until he gets his taxes done. Chrissy Clark is unpacking her last boxes of stuff in her new apartment in San Francisco. Then she's going to go to the local Zen Center and meditate about the impermanence of stuff. We also have Brendan Newnham, Phyllis Owens, who's catching up on her Oscar-nominated movies, Angela Kim, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Good luck with that ceiling fan this weekend, Peter. Jim Russell created the show. We hope you'll get a podcast of it for free at weekendamerica.org. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Hey, get out there and enjoy your weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, I'm Desiree Cooper, co-host of Weekend America. The weekends are for freedom.
Our job is to liberate them from the sensibilities and the conventions of their day-to-day life.
Now I just walk down the street and I'm like Mary Poppins. I'm free as a bird.
Forget the chores, the errands, and the weekend runaround. Liberate yourself with Weekend America, where great radio lives on the weekend.